Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
A Tale of Two Telescopes. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Two telescopes have captured images that have led scientists to a better understanding of our universe and our place in it. Launched in 2021, the Webb Space Telescope is capturing images of our cosmic past and exploring the atmospheres of planets outside our own solar system. We'll speak with Webb's Lee Feinberg about the success of the telescope and its plans for 2024. Then, a glimpse into Hubble Telescope's advancements in 2023 after launching over three decades ago. From finding out when our universe was created to helping other telescopes like Webb, Hubble is staying busy. We'll speak with NASA's Jennifer Wiseman about Hubble's discoveries, upcoming missions, and efforts to keep it operational for years to come. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The Webb Space Telescope launched at the end of 2021 and began beaming back incredible images of the cosmos in the summer of 2022. Since then, scientists are seeing deeper into our cosmic past than ever before and peering into the atmospheres of planets that exist outside our own solar system. It's an incredible machine that has led to some incredible images, and our next guest says the best is yet to come. Here to talk more about Webb's findings and future observations is Lee Feinberg, JWST Telescope Manager and Optics Lead. Lee, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
I looked, it was 2021 the last time you were on the show. JWST had not left the ground at this point, but now it has, and it's beaming back just incredible images that have captivated both myself, the general public, and astronomers. I'm wondering, as you look back on the say, year and a half of images we've gotten from JWST, what's been kind of the standouts for you?
For me personally, I think, of course, the main objective, you know, and what really drove the design was looking at the early universe. And I think JWST is really doing what we had hoped in terms of studying the early universe. And it's still very early in that process, but we're already, you know, have found many things that were surprising. And so I think it's very exciting.
You mentioned the clarity, which for someone who is not involved in astronomy and optics, I think what really got me was looking at one of my favorite images that the Hubble Space Telescope took, the Pillars of Creation, and then seeing JWST's capture of that same location in the sky and just the incredible detail. How is this telescope able to get such clarity like that? How do you manage to capture that?
You know, it actually turns out that the resolution of a telescope, how finely it can see details, is directly related to how large it is. You know, it's the wavelength divided by the diameter of the telescope. So being this large makes a huge difference. But there's a lot of other things that all have to work well. And one of the ones that's subtle is just how well it can point at an object and stay pointed in a very stable way. And we're finding that Webb is doing almost seven times better than we had, you know, set out to do in that regard. And that turns out to be seven times better than about Hubble does. So it's got this incredible stability. You know, when it points at something, it's incredibly stable, and its size gives it this incredible resolution. And I think those two things, of course, you know, with respect to Hubble images, Hubble looks mostly in the visible, a little bit in the near infrared. Webb is looking at wavelengths that Hubble can't see. These are infrared wavelengths, and these infrared wavelengths means that Webb can actually see through clouds of things that Hubble sees as clouds, but Webb can see through them and see stars. And so all of these things matter when you look at something like the Eagle Nebula or really almost anything.
You mentioned that stability and coming in at much better than expected. How does it stabilize itself? How do you keep it pointed in that little area that it needs to be pointed at?
And there's a lot of different layers of that. One of the most interesting layers of that is how there's a loop that happens where we actually have these special cameras, we call them guiders, that were built by the Canadian Space Agency. That was one of the international contributions. And these guiders look at a star and they find where is the center of that star. And they do this many times a second. and we call it centroiding. And then they feed that information to a mirror. We call it a fine steering mirror that then corrects any instability in the pointing. And so there's a loop. So that loop is happening about once, total loop is happening about once a second. And that's really critical for to give us the very stable images. There are many other layers, you know, for vibrations, if you will. We manage those by having mechanical means by which we isolate the telescope from things that cause vibration, like our reaction wheels. So it takes all of these different things working together, and there's probably four or five different layers that all have to work right in order to get the incredible stability. And of course, many of these layers are operating at very cold temperatures because the whole all the telescope and instruments are below minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, somewhere around 40, 50 Kelvin, so 40 to 50 degrees above absolute zero. So when I talk about cameras, and you know, that are centroiding on stars, and I talk about fine steering mirrors, all of that stuff is at these very cold temperatures. And that's a lot of what made it so difficult.
Lee, is there any concern that over time, this harsh environment may degrade those systems? And also, I'm thinking, you know, when you compare to Hubble, you think of Hubble, it's got almost like a lens cap on it, whereas these mirrors of JWST are exposed to this harsh environment of space. Is there any concern that this cold or debris may degrade the ability for this telescope to take these crystal clear images and peer back deeper into our cosmic past than ever before?
Webb is at the L2 Lagrange point, which is well past the moon in terms of how far it is from the Earth. And it actually turns out in a lot of ways, that's a better place to be than say in low Earth orbit, where you have things like orbital debris and radiation, you know, belts around the Earth. But like you say, there is still this one really critical issue, which is micrometeoroids. We do get micrometeoroids even at the L2 Lagrange point. In fact, the Geminids, which just passed through a couple days ago, those also pass through the L2 Lagrange point. So we keep an eye on the telescope when the Geminids pass by. About 5 months into the mission, we had one micrometeoroid that hit one of the mirrors that actually, it actually went through the mirror, made a tiny little hole, but it also made a little deformation around that hole. And that was a very unique, very highly energetic micrometeoroid. We expected micrometeoroids. We designed for that. And of course, like you say, unlike Hubble, Hubble has this large, we call it a barrel around, you know, the primary mirror, just like a lot of barrels you have on telescopes you use when you go in your backyard, that protects Hubble. And Webb doesn't have that. So that means that Webb is, you know, it does see these, we call them sporadic micrometeoroids from all sorts of different directions. We expected it, we planned for it, but it turns out every so often you are going to get one that's statistically very large. There's like a distribution in how energetic these are. So, you know, when the one hit it did concern us about what, you know, how frequent they would be. But, you know, since then we've done a lot of work to really understand this issue. And of course we haven't had another large one. I do expect over time, you know, every several years that we will probably have one that's similar to the one that hit. And we could tolerate many of these before you would even notice it in the images. But our expectation is that we will last for decades and you will not even notice it in the images, that they're so rare. Which is great news. Honestly, right now, we don't see anything that is a lifetime issue that is of concern. And of course, Webb was designed to last at least 5 years and a 10-year goal. And, you know, I think we've publicly said that we have enough fuel for 20, and some folks have been quoted as at least 25 years. And there's nothing we know about that will prevent us from doing just as amazing science as we're doing now for that long, but we'll keep an eye on it, you know, and continue to monitor everything. But so far we don't see any really concerns. And in fact, the L2 Lagrange point's turning out to be fairly benign otherwise.
Well, that is very good news. So essentially the telescope is like walking backwards, right? You're looking as it's behind itself, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, imagine if you're on a racetrack with a car and you wanted to point at, you know, some person in the stands, you'd rather point, you want to point at them. You want to turn your camera when you're going away from them so that something coming at you does not hit you in the opposite direction that you're moving. So that's exactly right. And that reduces the energy of hits. It reduces what we call the relative velocity by a factor of two, because it would double if something's coming at you.
That's fascinating. What a great solution too. Just turn around.
You know, people ask me, like, was there anything you were particularly surprised about when he got in space. And really, I think this was, this very rare statistical case of micrometeor was like the one thing that we just, we considered micrometeorites. We did analysis, we did testing. But, you really had to think about these very, very rare ones because they're so energetic. And those are the ones that are the ones that you can, you have to be aware of. So that was a lesson learned. In fact, in future observatory now, that we're starting to study sort of these follow-on observatories, we're thinking that we're going to want to have a barrel around the telescope so that we don't have to have this kind of, exposure that the Webb telescope has.
Right. And that was impossible with Webb, right? Because of it, just its sheer size, right? There's no way you could have launched that thing with a barrel on it, right?
Yeah. I mean, it would have had to deploy, obviously. You could do a deployable barrel, which would have been, but the real challenge of Webb is that Webb has to cool to 30 to 50 Kelvin. And the way that Webb cools is to emit its heat radiatively, meaning that it kind of gives the heat off in the form of infrared radiation. And it's, Webb, you put up this large sun shield and the telescope is on the cold side of the sun shield. So the spacecraft's on the warm side, meaning the sun and the Earth are on the side that the spacecraft's on. The telescope only sees the inner layer of the sun shield, which is cold, and it sees deep space. The way that Webb cools itself is to radiate to this very cold, deep space. If we had a barrel, we would not be radiating to deep space except in, one very small field. You'd be seeing the barrel, and the barrel would be seeing the sun. So it would have been a much more difficult problem from a cryogenic and thermal point of view.
Fascinating. As you mentioned in this conversation, Webb has taken some incredible images, images of galaxies. It's also taking observations of the composition of atmospheres of exoplanets. And as you also mentioned, it's designed to be in space for 5 years. We'll probably do 10. There's fuel for 20. What's ahead? Like, I mean, the bar is so high, Lee. What could you possibly do next?
The first year, a lot of the observations were geared towards understanding how well Webb was working. The second year, we call it cycle two, there is some more sort of what I call deeper or longer observations. But we still haven't done the equivalent of the Hubble Deep Field. When they did the Hubble Deep Field, they stared at a patch of sky for like a month. And that's how you get these really, really deep images. And there are two times you really want to do that. One is when you're looking at the, the early, early universe, the dark patch of sky. And what's these first, you get the best possible measurement of these early galaxies and early black holes. And the second time you want to do that is when you're studying exoplanets as they transit in front of stars, because measuring their atmosphere is really hard. So what you need is for them to go and transit multiple times, and you keep building up better and better data. And so those kinds of observations, the two of the most important science cases, right? Transiting exoplanets and the early universe, they really require, the more you observe, the better. And each cycle, I think we're going to be doing longer and longer observations. Cycle three starts, I believe, this July. So, maybe next year. Webb has already found a galaxy that is believed to have been 320 million years after the Big Bang, which I have to say is, we used to give talks about, what Webb would do. And we would often say, we thought the very first stars and galaxies formed about 300 million years after the Big Bang. So we're already on the verge of seeing those galaxies. But what we want to do is see even more of them and see them, and get spectra, see what the wavelength information is telling us about those galaxies, looking at the evolution of the chemicals on the periodic table, essentially. I personally don't think, we're anywhere near the full capabilities of Webb. I think it's going to happen every year incrementally as we go.
Lee, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on this incredible piece of hardware in space.
Oh, thank you, Brendan.
That was Lee Feinberg, JWST Telescope Manager and Optics Lead. Still to come, 3 decades of Hubble and the plan to keep the space telescope in orbit. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Launched in 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope has been capturing incredible images of our universe over the course of its three decades in orbit. The spacecraft continues to help astronomers understand our place in the universe, and it's assisting other space missions, too. Here to talk about Hubble's legacy, how it's working with other science missions, and plans to keep the telescope in orbit for years to come is Jennifer Wiseman, Senior Project Scientist on Hubble at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to join you.
So I was looking at our archives, and the last time we had you on the show, you were talking about 30 years of Hubble, and that was 3 years ago, which is wild. What has happened in the past 3 years that you are particularly exciting, you know, past this incredible milestone of 30 years for Hubble?
3 years ago, we were battling the beginnings of the pandemic and all of that. But I'm very proud of our Hubble team that we were able to keep the Hubble mission operating seamlessly during the pandemic, even though we had to work out, you know, different arrangements for the technical staff on the ground to work safely and so forth. But we were able to do that. So Hubble science continued with no glitch because of the pandemic. And we have some just incredible science that's coming out from Hubble. In particular, we are doing things that are trying to help other missions be the best they can be, as well as Hubble be the best we can be, by doing complementary things. So one of my favorites is that we observed the impact of the DART mission. So if you may have heard of that, the DART mission was designed to intentionally send something to ram into an asteroid to see what would happen if we can really change the trajectory or something about the orbital characteristics of an asteroid by impacting it. And of course, this is kind of a preliminary effort to seeing if we would be capable of redirecting a dangerous incoming asteroid sometime in the future. So that was what the DART mission was for. Well, we watched that impact with the Hubble Space Telescope and saw the initial debris coming off of the asteroid from the impact. And now here we are many, many months later, and Hubble is still watching this asteroid. Actually, you know, it was a binary pair. So the initial test was to see if the orbital characteristics of that binary pair around each other would be changed by the impact. And I think preliminary results suggest yes. But we're also seeing that there's these boulders that are gently floating off of the asteroid now, after the impact, months later. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a few half a mile per hour, you know, very, very slow moving boulders. But it's showing us that these impacts can actually loosen off debris that's already on top of these loosely held asteroids and can create a whole swarm of little bodies that are moving. And so that's something to fit into the studies. And that's an example of how Hubble has been used to complement some other mission in the recent years.
It's also working with JWST as well, right? Can you talk a bit about how Hubble is complementing some of the work that its newest space telescope neighbor and colleague is doing?
What people may not realize is that Webb was designed to see kinds of light that Hubble was not really designed to detect as well. So, and vice versa. So we have now this complementary pair of great observatories that are observing things and studying things in deep space much better in a complementary way than either could on their own. So the Webb was designed to see light, red colored light, but really more into the infrared part of the electromagnetic spectrum of light. So this is light that's redder than red. And Hubble sees a little bit of what we call near infrared light, but Hubble also sees visible light like our eyes see, and then that energetic bluer than blue light, the ultraviolet light that is emitted by energetic processes throughout the universe. So we are particularly excited about science that's using the capabilities of both Hubble and Webb now, and presumably their planets. And Webb was designed to actually see some of the earliest baby galaxies just as they were forming in the universe. That's because those galaxies are so far away that as the light travels toward us, it travels through the universe that is expanding or stretching And that has the impact of stretching the light, in a sense, or making it redder. And of course, for the most distant galaxies, even if the light started out as blue, it becomes infrared by the time it gets to us. And Webb is better suited to pick out those distant galaxies. But Webb is not as well suited to understand the details of what's going on inside those galaxies in terms of the patches of star formation and what's happening there. So we use Hubble to look at the details of star formation and structure in galaxies that are closer to us, that the light is not as redshifted. And then we can extrapolate from that to what we're seeing with Webb and really build a full picture of how galaxies began to form billions of years ago in the early universe and how galaxies over time have merged with other galaxies and grown bigger, how stars within them have been formed and come and gone. So studying that whole process of galaxy formation and evolution over 13.8 billion years of time is enriched now because we have both Webb and Hubble looking at this interesting challenge.
This is a telescope that has been in space for 3 decades. Your job is to ensure that the Hubble mission is as scientifically productive as possible. Is that becoming more and more a challenge as it ages? And, you know, what challenges do you have in making sure that this observatory is as productive as it can be?
Sure. So Hubble was launched from the space shuttle way back in 1990. It was deployed from the space shuttle in low Earth orbit. And it was always designed to be a facility that would be refreshed, refurbished, whatever needed to be done for maintenance by astronauts. And so we have done that over the years. We've done 5 servicing missions to the Hubble Space Telescope, and each mission was different, but some of them were designed to do some repairs on instruments or to some of the supporting equipment on Hubble, like its pointing control systems, its gyroscopes, or replacing its batteries or replacing its solar panels. Hubble is powered by the sun, so we have had to replace its solar panels. And then we've also put in new science instruments on Hubble from time to time to give it new and fresh scientific capabilities. So that's what's kept Hubble going so long in one respect, are these astronaut servicing missions. But ever since the space shuttle program has been retired, we haven't had a way to send astronauts to Hubble to do that kind of full-up servicing mission. But the last one we did in 2009 was very successful. I mean, it took years to prepare that mission. So the telescope is still in terrific shape right now. We are actually getting more science from Hubble now than ever before. And believe it or not, in that 33-year mission.
There have been some conversations about trying to extend the life of Hubble. What are some of those ideas, Dr. Weissman, and how might that actually go about happening?
So there's several ways that we are working to try to make sure the Hubble mission is as scientifically strong as possible. We're looking at ways of making sure that we have a good core of science instruments operating for many years to come. But we're also paying attention to Hubble's orbit. Hubble is in low Earth orbit, and its orbit naturally decays. Anything in low Earth orbit naturally begins to fall slowly because of slight friction with the tiny, tiny bits of Earth's atmosphere that are still up at that level. So we're looking at ways of maybe boosting Hubble back up to something a little higher, like back up to that 600-kilometer regime, just to give it a few more years of operation. And we've been conducting a study, actually, that was commissioned by NASA to work with SpaceX to see if this is even technically feasible. And that study is complete. And now the findings are at NASA headquarters. NASA headquarters is trying to study that and make some policy decisions on whether or not this is a good idea. And one more regime I'll bring to your attention is our archive. So we pay particular attention and pride to our data archive. So when observations are done with Hubble, they're used by the scientists who proposed them, but the data are put in these archival storage units that can be accessed by anyone around the world. And Many of our science results already are coming from data that have been pulled out of the archive. And so in some sense, you're getting double or triple the bang for the buck. It's a wonderful thing, the data being used for maybe some other kind of science question that wasn't part of the original proposal to do those particular observations, or finding trends in the data.
Finally, Dr. Wiseman, is there any particular campaign or particular observation in the coming months that you're particularly excited about that you can share with us?
One of the things I'm particularly thrilled about is that scientists and people around the world are realizing that with over three decades of Hubble observations, we can find some trends that we might have not noticed if we'd only done one observation. So one of those, this past year, we came out with a press release, is that a team realized that in our own solar system, we have a situation where we have clouds on Neptune that come and go, and we're not sure why, but it turns out that those clouds that appear and then kind of subside over a few years of cycle, those year cycles are about 11 years, and they correlate with the solar cycle. So now we're realizing that even though Neptune is way out in the far solar system, that something that the sun is doing when it's very active is reaching Neptune, and with a tiny bit of a time delay that you would expect, it's stirring up cloud formation in Neptune. And we can see that with Hubble. And then as the solar cycle subsides, then those clouds subside. So now is the task is for planetary scientists to figure out what exactly is inciting the cloud formation in Neptune. I continue to be excited about what we're studying in these exoplanets and what we're going to learn about their nature. And I'm particularly interested in understanding how galaxies have changed over cosmic time to be able to be the places like our own Milky Way, where we have stars that form planetary systems with terrestrial planets, and at least one that has is sustaining life. So learning more about that using Hubble and Webb observations is something that particularly interests me. So those are kind of the generic realms that I'm interested in, but you'll have to stay tuned for the actual news releases as we start putting them forth in the coming months.
Sounds good. That is a perfect answer and gives us plenty to look forward to. So Dr. Jennifer Wiseman is Senior Project Scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Dr. Wiseman, thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Brendan.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. And until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.